Hello again, welcome back. This is Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs of Atida and the Web Yeshiva with the third installment in our series on Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik's The Lonely Man of Faith. Last time, we, again, by way of introduction and looking at the first chapter, we led up to this piece of Parshanut, Rabbi Soloveitchik's analysis of the two accounts of creation in Bereshit chapter 1, Genesis chapter 1, versus that in chapter 2. Rabbi Soloveitchik drew our attention to four critical differences in the account of man's creation. And the rest of the book is largely going to be, the rest of the essay is largely going to be working off of these four differences. It's not a commentary. The attempt to explain away these four differences might have been done without drawing our attention to these four differences. It seems to be more a homiletical point that he organizes his thought about religion in contemporary or modern society within the framework of this within the framework of this homiletical point. But he does use it as the axis around which revolves the following discussion. And again, just a quick summary. In Genesis chapter 1, again on the website you have in greater detail and with English translation, although I'm hoping that you all have access to a Chumash, to an English Bible, if you need it, and if not, certainly there are many resources online. But in Bereshit chapter 1, we read, Vayivra elo kim et ha'adam b'tzalmo b'tzelem elokim bara oto, that God, here using God's name Elohim, created man in him, in his image, in the image of God, he, God, created him man. Zachar u'nekeva bara otam, male and female he created them. Vayivarech otam Elokim, vayomer lahem Elokim, pruervu malu et ha'aretz. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful, multiply, fill the land, vikiv shuha, and dominate it and conquer it, subdue it. Urdu bitgat hayam, vofa shemayim, vchol chayarim et stalaretz. And man should be the master of creation and should control and be in mastery over the birds of the sky, the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, and the beasts of the field. However, in Genesis chapter 2, it says, V'yitzer elo, Hashem Elokim, here using not merely the name Elokim, but the proper name of God, the tetragrammation, the four-letter name, Yud, He, Vav, and He, the name that we pronounce as if it's written A-D-O-N-A-I, but in reality is written Yud, He, Vav, and He, a name which we is so holy that we make a point not of even pronouncing it, even within the context of prayer or Torah study. So, V'yitzer Hashem Elokim et ha'adam, Afar min ha'adama, dust of the ground. In chapter 1, we're created in the image of God. In chapter 2, we are dust and dirt. Vayipach ba'apav nishmat chayim, God breathed into the inchoate, the unanimated nostrils of this creature, brings him to life. God plants a gan be'eden, a garden in Eden. V'ikach Hashem Elokim et ha'adam, v'yenachehu began Eden. He places man in gan Eden, la'avda u'leshamra, to till and to conserve, to work and to guard this land, this garden, as opposed to the imperative to conquer the world, man in chapter 2 has a different orientation. He is there to toil away at the land, to till the land, to work the land, to conserve the land in the modern parlance, to guard the land, to watch it. Vayomer Hashem Elokim lo tov hayot adam levado. Eseh lo ezer kenegdo. Since it's not good for man to be alone, I will make for him a spouse. As opposed to the first chapter, where man and women are created simultaneously, or at least so it appears, here there's a two-step process, and marriage comes about, the union between man and woman comes about, as a response to a value judgment, as a response to the fact that it's not good for man to be alone. Throughout the rest of chapter 1, Rabbi Soloveitchik lays out a description of the character of Adam One, or Adam the First, the personality of man as he is typified, as he is characterized in the first chapter. And that's what we'll get through tonight. And next time, we'll move on to Adam the Second. Just a quick programming note. Next week, of course, our class doesn't meet because it's Shavuot. I mean, where you are, it might only be Erev Shavuot at that time, but by us, we'll already have finished the cheesecake, so we won't meet next week, and I sincerely apologize, but the following week I will be traveling, and I will be unavailable. I'll be away for a week, and we won't meet, so there'll be 2 weeks without a session, but don't worry, I'll leave you with plenty to do before we leave tonight. Before we go on into the characterization of Adam First, are there any questions on what we've done until now in the past 2 weeks and a bit? Any thoughts, any questions, any ideas? Because until now, really, it's been introduction, and now we're really moving ahead. Okay, speak now or forever hold your peace. Okay. Let us portray these two men. Hold on, let me look. Is there an implication that man created in chapter 2 is not created in God's image? Let's hold off on that question, Sherry, until we get to Adam the Second. Let us portray these two men, Adam the First and Adam the Second. And again, these are nicknames, these are typologies. He's distilling down his reading, his understanding of the two accounts at the beginning of Sefer Bereishit, into these two typologies, these two typological categories, these two characters. Obviously, there aren't two characters. There may not even be one character, because in a certain way, those descriptions of Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 are talking about Adam, the first man, but it's also talking about mankind, about humanity. And again, go back to the asterisk that I laid down the first time in terms of the gendered language. We're talking about Adam, we're talking about man, but we're talking about humanity, men and women. So this idea of trying to distill something down into a typological category is a very typical Soloveitchikian device that Rabbi Soloveitchik used in throughout his writing in different ways. Halachic man is a typology. It's a pure construct trying to depict something about halacha as embodied in the practitioner of the halacha. The Lonely Man of Faith is a typology. Whether or not it corresponds to actual people is less relevant. Very often, one of Rabbi Soloveitchik's favored modes of discourse was actually the hesped, the eulogy. As one of the leaders of the Jewish community in America in the 20th century, he was often called on to speak at funerals, at memorial services for other leading figures in the Jewish world. And on those occasions, very often, he would, instead of speaking about the deceased, he would create this typological construct of a certain personality type, and then explain how the dearly departed was an embodiment of this type of person. But really, he was talking about this abstract character. There was an article a number of years ago analyzing some of Rabbi Soloveitchik's eulogies, the eulogy as a teaching device, as a literary device, and how he would do this distillation of characters. And here he's doing it again. There is no doubt that the term image of God, B'Tselem Elokim, that man is created in the image of God, here we're on page 12 in the edition that we're working with, that B'Tselem Elokim in the first account refers to man's inner charismatic endowment as a creative being. What does it mean to be created B'Tselem Elokim in God's image? So Rabbi Soloveitchik makes a very interesting possibly innovative statement. When we say that we are created in God's image, of course, the Jewish worldview is that it doesn't mean a physical image. It doesn't mean that we have, two hands and two nostrils and two eyes and two feet, because that's what God has. God has no body. He is completely non-corporeal. So in what way are we created in his image? So there are different interpretations that are given. Among them being that we are ruach mimalala, that we are communicative beings, that we use language, that's what distinguishes us. That's what makes us in God's image. Rabbi Soloveitchik says that to be in God's image means that you are a creative being, that the image of God means to be creative. And when we say that Adam the first, Adam one, is created, B'Tselem Elokim, that means that he is creative. More on creativity in a moment. Man's likeness to God expresses itself in man's striving and ability to become a creator. God is many things. We relate to God in different ways. But first and foremost, he is Borei Olam. He is the creator of the world. He's also the lawgiver. We also relate to him as our Father in heaven, metaphorically speaking. We also refer to him as our King. And those are two different ways of approaching him, and we try to do both. We speak of God as the God who manifests himself in history. There are many, many, many different ways that we relate to God. C.S. Lewis once very beautifully said, we all talk about him as a father in heaven, but really we would prefer a grandfather in heaven. A kindly old man with a white beard who passes us a sweet, pats us on the head, and says at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what's happened, everything will be okay. But in fact, we relate to God as a father in heaven. A father is someone that has a responsibility to discipline, and to a parent has that responsibility to guide, lovingly guide, but to guide. In God's image, means that we are creative beings, not our physical. Yes, correct. John is emphasizing. Oh, in a private chat to me, John, I hope it's okay if I can mention this to everyone. I'm not sure if you send this to me privately on purpose to everyone, but again, in other words, physically, not physically, but in our creative nature. And this is the Jewish way of thinking about it. Adam the first, who was fashioned in the image of God, was blessed with great drive for creative activity and immeasurable resources for the realization of this goal. the most outstanding of which is the intelligence, the human mind, capable of confronting the outside world and inquiring into its complex workings. Now, when Rabbi Soloveitchik talks about creativity, this is the plane on which he normally refers to it. As a matter of fact, if you will read Rabbi Soloveitchik's important essay, Halachic Man, perhaps more important an essay than The Lonely Man of Faith, but slightly harder to make one's way through. In Halachic Man, the whole essay is about 100 pages long, 120 pages long, something like that. In the Halachic Man, the first 40% is this typological description of who this character is. And then the larger second section is entitled His Creative Capacity. That the hallmark of Halachic Man is his creative capacity. And that's really one of the fullest articulations of the role of creativity in the religious life. But there, creativity is the kind of creativity that he mentions here in this sentence, largely confronting the outside world and inquiring into its complex workings, a type of intellectual creativity. For the Halachic Man, it's a creativity which is often very much focused on the creativity of scholarship, of halachic scholarship, of Jewish learning, creativity in that sense, the creativity of the Beit Midrash. But not only, and here certainly not only. Here certainly not only. In spite of the boundless, Rabbi Soloveitchik makes a reference at the in these notes here, which in this edition are the notes are signed with a little Jewish star. I don't think that's how it was originally printed, but in the note here to the footnote at the bottom, the sources that he draws our attention to are in the Rambam, in Hilchot Yesodei HaTorah, which is in the Rambam's Sefer Mada, the Book of Wisdom, and in the Mora Nevuchim, in the Guide for the Perplexed, at the very beginning of the Guide for the Perplexed, which you can access online in English or in Hebrew. If you can't find that, email me and I will email you those links if you're interested in seeing them. This is an interesting phenomenon. I'm not sure how these editorial decisions were made, that the references to the Jewish sources are made in a way they're given in shorthand. They're given in insider code. Instead of saying Maimonides, Guide of the Perplexed, Book 1, Chapter 1, the reference is given Mora Nevuchim by the Hebrew title. And this may be, actually, not merely an odd, you know, editorial curios. The essay itself, as I mentioned, is formulated very much in a universalistic language, the universalistic language of religion, and less specifically in the specific particularistic jargon of the Jewish religion. The sources, when he mentions them, and often many sources are not even mentioned, they're given in passing, and the references to rabbinic Talmudic texts, the particulars of Jewish texts, are relegated to footnotes. And that's a very interesting methodological point. But if you are interested in seeing them, so you should find them. And if you need help, I will help you with that. In spite of the boundless divine generosity providing man with many intellectual capacities and interpretive perspectives in his approach to reality, God, in imparting the blessing to Adam the first and giving him the mandate to subdue nature, the blessing here, Vayavarech Otam Elokim, God blessed, God created them, and then he blesses them. But this is a blessing that's not like, you know, you should grow up to be smart. It's a blessing which is a charge. It's an imperative. It's a mandate. Vayavarech Otam Vayomer Lehem, Pruvu Melua Ta'aretz, be fruitful and multiply. It's not a blessing in the sense, I hope you have many nice, fine children. It's a command. It's a directive. This is the task of man, to subdue the world, to conquer the world. He will later have more to say about this term, vikivshuha. God, in imparting the blessing to Adam the first and giving him the mandate to subdue nature, directed Adam's attention to the functional and practical aspects of his intellect through which man is able to gain control of nature. Adam the first, I'm skipping ahead to page 13. Adam the first is interested in just a single aspect of reality and asks only one question. He asks one question only. How does the cosmos function? He's not fascinated by the question, why does the cosmos function at all? Nor, by cosmos, you can substitute nature here. He's not interested in the why question, nor is he interested in the question of what is the essence of the world, of nature, of the cosmos. He is only curious to know how it works, and he is interested in knowing how it works because of his need. His need to master the world. It's a utilitarian, practical question. Can everybody see the page I'm displaying? I'm told by Pesach that he doesn't see it. Okay. Pesach, did it show up for you? Ezra, perhaps touch base with the Pesach. Pesach, reach out to Ezra, our tech support, and vice versa. So again, Adam the first is interested in how, not why, not what. A very practical, pragmatic question. He is concerned not with the question per se, but with its practical implications. He raises not a metaphysical, but a practical, technical how question. Metaphysical meaning synonymous here with philosophical. To be precise, his question is related not to the genuine functioning of the cosmos in itself, but to the possibility of reproducing the dynamics of the cosmos by employing quantified, mathematized media, which man evolves through postulation and creative thinking. The connative means like the impulsive movement of attraction, which Adam the first experiences toward the world, is not of an exploratory cognitive nature. It is rather nurtured by the selfish desire on the part of Adam to better his own position in relation to his environment. Sherry points out that this is a description of the scientific method, and absolutely, absolutely so. Again, Sherry, this is not, don't confuse the cart and the horse. This is not a shi'ur on, Rabbi Soloveitchik is not giving us a shi'ur on Chumash. He has a notion of a type which he's drawing on a biblical description, but he's not trying to explain to you the words per se in Bereshit chapter 1 the way, let's say, that Rashi or the Ramban are doing. He's using it as a philosophical springboard. You're not going to be able to go back and read everything into the words of Bereshit, chapter 1. Adam the first is overwhelmed by one quest. Namely, I'm sorry, let me go back a second. The scientific method, and particularly that of the mathematician. Why mathematics? mathematics happens to have been a field that was very interesting to Rabbi Soloveitchik. If you look at the Halachic Man, which I mentioned is a very, very important book. When it was written, that was originally written in Hebrew and then later translated into English, but it was published, unfortunately, without an index. And a couple of years ago, I was fortunate to be the person that prepared the index to the Halachic Man. Alan or whomever, let's make a contest. Somebody Google index to Halachic Man. You'll find it posted someplace and you can send the link to the PDF. It's interesting to look through the index. And when I prepared the index, the person for whom I prepared it made a suggestion. Here it is. Made a suggestion that here I'm putting it in the chat box. That's a link to the PDF, which if you have a copy of if you have a copy of Halachic Man, so print out the index and stick it in the back. Rabbi Soloveitchik was not a mathematician. He did study mathematics at a certain point. His university degrees were in philosophy, but he had a very strong interest in the philosophy of science. As a matter of fact, another one of his very important books called The Halachic Mind, which was published only at the end of his life, although it had been written 40 or 50 years earlier and left unpublished, is very much an exploration of the history of the philosophy, rather, the philosophy of science and how it correlates to halachic thinking. But in the index to the Halachic Man, what's interesting to look through are the sources on which he's drawing, the Jewish and the general sources. And when I put it together, it's a source index to see the sources on which he's drawing, the Torah sources, but there's also, of course, a topical index. And an index of names. So you can see, so when I put it together, the person suggested that I put in next to each of the names a very, very, very brief biographical word about each of them. So, for example, when he's talking about Moses, for that, all I put next to it is to say that it's a biblical character. But when he mentions Karl Barth. Karl Barth was a Swiss Protestant theologian who's mentioned in passing twice in the book. So I put down his dates. I tell you when he lived and who he was. When he mentions Bergson and Berkeley and Bergman, and then in the next breath, Rav Meir Bar Ilan and the Netziv Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda of Berlin and Chaim Nachman Bialik. I mentioned those things, but what's interesting is to look through the biography of names and to see the array of thinkers and writers and philosophers and mathematicians and scientists on whom he's to whom he's referring and on whom he's drawing. And you see that there's a very heavy dose of scientific thinkers and mathematicians as well. Why mathematics? Because mathematics, as opposed to biology and chemistry and even physics, although physics in many ways approaches mathematics is about distilling reality into abstract constructs. And that was something that Rabbi Soloveitchik thought had parallels to halacha. That halacha, again, halacha, not with a lowercase h, but with a capital H, halacha as the word which stands in for the whole system of Jewish thought. and Jewish life and Jewish learning is a reflection of an ideal which is implemented in the physical world. And this is the theme of the first section of the Halachic Man, and there are echoes of it here as well. The abstractification of reality into pure principles is a form of conquering kivshuha through the intellect of the world, of understanding how, not what, not why. Adam the first is overwhelmed by one quest, namely to harness and dominate the elemental natural forces and to put them at his disposal. This practical interest arouses his will to learn the secrets of nature. He is completely utilitarian. He is completely utilitarian as far as his motivation, teleology, design, methodology are concerned. Now, Rabbi Soloveitchik asks, what is Adam the first out to achieve? What is the object towards which he incessantly drives himself with enormous speed? The objective, it is self-evident, can be only one, namely, that which God put up before him, to be man, to be himself. Adam the first wants to be human, to discover his identity, which is bound up with his humanity. How does Adam find himself? He works with a simple equation introduced by the psalmist, by King David in Sefer Tehillim, who proclaim the singularity and unique station of man in nature. This is, and again, he doesn't even give you the source for this. This is Tehillim, chapter 8, verse 6. For thou made him a little lower than the angels, and hast crowned him with glory and honor. Honor, parentheses, dignity. These are synonyms. V'tachasreihu ma'at me'elohim, u'kvod v'hadar te'atreihu. Kavod. And hadar. I remind you of the essay I posted last week, Majesty and Humility, which has echoes here. Here in the footnote, he mentions, as a matter of fact, the term kavod has a dual meaning in Hebrew. Majesty, as in the phrase kvod malchuto, and dignity, as in the halachic phrase kvod habriot. That majesty and dignity in Jewish thought are synonymous. That the notion that each person is ha possesses dignity, is entitled to dignity, is a reflection of our idea that each person has autonomy, each person has integrity, each person has a uniqueness to him or her, and in respect for that, they are the bearers of and entitled to dignity, but it is that way in which each person is majestic, is a king or queen unto themselves, or at least a king and queen, a sovereign over themselves, a reflection of their own free will, which is not possessed by other creatures. And because of that, they possess or are entitled to dignity. They don't always achieve it. They don't always maintain it. They don't always earn it. They don't always receive it, even when they have earned it. But in principle, that is what he believes. And again, we are talking about man qua man. We are not talking about Jews and not Gentiles. This is a universalistic statement. That man is just a bit lower than the angels. We discussed this many times in many different ways. It was a theme that kept coming up again and again in our last series when we studied the Rambam's Shmona Prakim, the Maimonides, the eight chapters of Maimonides. This notion that man is but a hair's breadth away from the angel, that we're this odd, bizarre, synthesis of being godlike and being beastlike. And the struggle between the two is what defines, is the defining challenge of humanity and of the religious personality. Man is an honorable being. In other words, man is a dignified being, and to be a human means to live with dignity. Page 15. However, this equation of two unknown qualities requires further elaboration. We must be ready to answer the question, what is dignity, and how can it be realized? The answer we find again in the words of the psalmist in Tehillim, who addresses himself to the obvious question, who termed man not only an honorable but also a glorious being, spelling out the essence of glory in unmistakable terms. Thou hast made him to have dominion over the work of thy hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet. That's the next pasuk. This is Tehillim chapter 8, verse 7. In other words, dignity was equated by the psalmist with man's capability of dominating his environment and exercising control over it, so that when God commands man, v'kivshuha, subdue creation, master creation, it is the imperative to acquire dignity. Man acquires dignity through glory, through his majestic posture vis-a-vis his environment. Insofar as we are the kings of creation, obviously, maybe king with a lowercase k, the king with a capital K is the actual creator. But to the degree which we are responsible for creation, we gain majesty and we gain dignity. The brute's existence, a primitive person, primitive man's existence, is an undignified one because it's a helpless existence. Human existence is dignified one, is a dignified one because it is a glorious, majestic, powerful existence. Dignity is unobtainable as long as man has not reclaimed himself from coexistence with nature and has not risen from non-reflective, degradingly helpless, instinctive life to an intelligent, planned, and majestic one. For the sake of clarification of the double equation, humanity equals dignity, and dignity equals this concept of glory majesty, it is necessary to add another thought. There is no dignity without responsibility. And one cannot assume responsibility as long as he is not capable of living up to his commitments. Only when man rises to the heights of freedom of action and creativity of mind does he begin to implement the mandate of dignified responsibility entrusted to him by his maker. You know, this idea that majesty, to be a king, means you don't have to do anything. I don't know, I can't speak for kings and queens today. But the idea that you subdue nature, the idea that you can control the world, means not that you're exempt from responsibility, but on the contrary, you are burdened with even more responsibility. And the execution of those responsibilities is your own path to dignity, what he calls here dignified responsibility. Dignified responsibility means there's nothing more majestic than having responsibilities and fulfilling them. We who are adults, I think we're all adults here online, or at least young adults. We have a few young adults with us. Maybe those young adults are first experiencing this. I know it's something that we try to teach our own children. You know, this idea that you know, sometimes when you teach school, I taught 12th grade once upon a time in America before coming to live in Israel. And I remember 12th graders having this notion that they were already adults or virtually adults. And they thought that the idea that people made demands on them, that they had responsibilities, was an indication that they were being treated like children. And that very thought was an indication that, in fact, that they are children. Because when you're an adult, you realize that part of being an adult is having responsibilities. Part of being an adult is people having expectations of you. And fulfilling those responsibilities is the very sign of your maturity. But, there becomes that, that kind of loop of illogic where you can't explain to somebody who has not yet achieved maturity why they're being immature. So, they just have to do the hard work of growing up on their own. We have a notion, and again, to put it in halachic terminology, which again, Rabbi Soloveitchik is not doing, the idea of Ein ben chorin ela misha osek batorah, God freed us from Egypt. We were slaves in Egypt. He brings us out of Egypt, and our conception of redemption, our conception of freedom, is not to throw off the shackles of responsibility, but to embrace a whole new set of responsibility. To not be slaves to Pharaoh, but to be avadim to a different king, the Melech Malchei Amlochim. That we weren't looking to not have responsibilities. We weren't looking to not have a master over us. We were looking to have the proper master over us. That was the whole notion of the Torah. That's, Sherry points out, the whole notion of the yoke of Torah, the Ol HaTorah, that we exchanged one set of avdut for a different type of being ovdim. And even in Hebrew, the two play off each other. To be a slave and to be a worshiper are the same root. Dignity of man expressing itself in the awareness of responsibility and of being capable of discharging his responsibility cannot be realized as long as he has not gained mastery over his environment. And that is the reason, of course, that slaves, in the time when we had slavery, that Jewish slaves, that slaves are exempt from certain mitzvot, because they are unable to be master of their own selves, of their own time, of their own world. This was another theme that interested Rabbi Soloveitchik, and he addressed it in a number of places. For life in bondage to insensate elemental forces is a non-responsible and hence an undignified affair. Man of old who could not fight disease and succumbed in multitudes to yellow fever or to any other plague with degrading helplessness could not lay claim to dignity. And here Rabbi Soloveitchik lays forth the type of creativity that Adam the First has to engage in, which is not merely the kind of abstract intellectual creativity, but a creativity of a more practical, this worldly order. Only the man who builds hospitals, discovers therapeutic techniques, and saves lives is blessed with dignity. Man of the 17th and 18th centuries who needed several days to travel from Boston to New York was less dignified than modern man who attempts to conquer space, boards a plane at a New York airport at midnight, several hours later can take a leisurely walk along the streets of London. Now, there are a few biographical points here. One, of course, is that Rabbi Soloveitchik traveled back and forth from Boston to New York every week. And of course, as I mentioned, the essay is published in 1965, at the height of the space race, which was something that greatly interested Rabbi Soloveitchik, apparently, I'm told. The space race, the race to the moon, the idea that we could send people to distant worlds. There were, it's interesting. I think there's been some written on this. In the 1960s, theologians, both Jewish and Gentile, were interested in this question of the space race. There was interest in the question of the implications of finding extraterrestrial life. We didn't know what we would find when we went out there. Space, the final frontier. Seek out new life and new civilizations. What would happen? What would be the implications for religion here on Earth if we were to discover extraterrestrial life? And people, there were religious traditions that found that idea very threatening, that it would break down our conceptions of ourselves and authority. And there were others that thought it was improper for man to be exploring space. After all, there's a pasuk in Tehillim, there's a verse in Psalms, Hashamayim shamayim l'Hashem, v'ha'aretz natan livnei Adam. The heavens are the heavens of the Lord. The earth is for man. And therefore, we would be invading foreign territory if we were to go out into space. And there were even Jewish opinions that stated such things. Rabbi Soloveitchik was very engaged by the whole notion of the space program. And obviously for this very reason. What a fascinating experiment, what a fascinating puzzle, what a fascinating challenge of creativity to harness both the human imagination and our scientific knowledge and the physical world, the world of physics, and just the sheer gumption of it, which was so fascinating and did capture the imagination of so much of the world in the 1960s. That here was a challenge that we could do it. When President Kennedy said that within a decade we should land a man on the moon and return him to the earth, I mean, we see that clip now, and it. Certainly, for those of us that aren't old enough to remember it, maybe perhaps some of you do remember it. I'd be happy if you have thoughts about it or memories of it to share that with everyone else. But it was something that fired the imagination of an entire generation throughout the planet. And Rabbi Soloveitchik saw that as a positive religious impulse. That was part of the creativity which is built into man, to humanity as a religious being. That is part of v'kivshuha. The brute is helpless and therefore not dignified. Civilized man has gained limited control of nature and has become, in certain respects, her master. And with his mastery, he has attained dignity. Hence, Adam the First is aggressive, bold, victory-minded. His motto is success, triumph over the cosmic forces. He engages in creative work, trying to imitate his master, his maker, imitatio Dei, lehidamot b'Hashem, that we are commanded in the Torah to imitate God. Generally, we assume that means that we know something of God's characteristics through his actions, and therefore those become models which we should follow. Mahu rachum af anu rachum. God is merciful. We know that through his actions. So therefore, we should act mercifully. But also, God is a creator. He is a master of nature, and that is something we should aspire to. Yes, correct. Joel's point is correct, that the search for dignity is not something that comes to us automatically. It's what we achieve through working at this. The most characteristic representative of Adam I is the mathematical scientist, and this goes back to what I mentioned earlier, who whisks us away from the array of tangible things, from color, sound, heat, touch, smell, which are only phenomenal accessible to our senses, into a formal relational world of thought constructs, of abstract constructs. The product of his arbitrary postulating and spontaneous positing and deducting. This world, woven out of human thought processes, functions with amazing precision and runs parallel to the workings of the real, meaning the physical, multifarious world of our senses. Let me just, these chats are coming in fast. Let me just take a look. David, I'm not sure I understand your question. What's the semantic play you're suggesting? I mean, I assume that there are different definitions of dignity. He is developing one concept of it here in the previous pages that we've been reading this evening. He's laying forth his definition. This is a Jewish. Can you hear me? Hello? Yes, okay. Let me just return. In other words, it's a Jewish definition in the sense that as a representative of the Jewish tradition, he is putting forth his definition of human dignity as a religious value. He is not channeling for you necessarily the opinion of some other Jewish thinker. He is putting forth his own philosophical religious statement. Are there other competing definitions of dignity? Certainly. But in other words, by choosing, it's not merely semantics. He chooses a term. He's rooted it in a source, in this case, a verse from Tehillim, but that's less important than the concept which he's doing it. By choosing a headline or a title or a word, it's something that helps get our mind around something. But what's essential here is putting down a marker for the kind of activity that we are charged with and the result of that activity through the creativity that he's describing. Man fulfills his destiny. He executes his responsibility, and that is the source of dignity. That's the source of dignity, dignity being majestic majesty, gaining control over oneself and one's environment. Again, David, I'm not 100% sure I understand what's troubling you here. But yes, in other words, conquer the land, the Kivshuha of Genesis chapter 1, he's reading or he's using it as a peg to hang this idea that that is the task of Adam the First, who has to master his environment, who has to seek dignity, he has to. This is a topic we haven't gotten to yet, how that goes about, how that impacts on the society he has to build. We'll see that Adam II, next time we meet, has a different orientation. And these are not two different characters, but two two dual ways that man has to function in the world. We are all both Adam the First and Adam the Second. It's not that one is better and one is worse. These are the two modes through which we occupy the world. And moving from one to the other is going to be the main task of the book. And again, the discussion of the space of the space program was probably just a timely example to point to. No, so this is a different definition of dignity. He's packing the term dignity with a different value. Here, yes. The modern scientist does not try, we're on the top of page 18. The modern scientist does not try to explain nature. He only duplicates it in his full resplendent glory as a creative agent of God. He constructs his own world and in mysterious fashion succeeds in controlling his environment through manipulating his own mathematical constructs and creations. Adam the First is not only a creative theoretician, he is also a creative aesthete. Someone, an aesthete, like aesthetics, someone who has a sensitivity to beauty. He fashions ideas in his mind and beauty with his heart. He enjoys both his intellectual and his aesthetic creativity and takes pride in it. He also displays creativity in the world of the norm. He legislates for himself norms and laws because a dignified existence is an orderly one. This is an interesting notion of the social contract. He's not talking about laws, religious laws. He's talking here about civil law. That part of society's idea in creating a system of governance, that we live in societies of law, that's also a form of creative activity. It's also a form of vekiv shuha, of conquering nature, in this sense, social nature. It lends dignity, it lends order. Anarchy and dignity are mutually exclusive. He is this worldly minded, finitude oriented, beauty centered. Adam the First is always an aesthete, whether engaged in an intellectual or an ethical performance. His conscience is energized not by the idea of the good, but by that of the beautiful. His mind is questing not for true, but for the pleasant and functional, which are rooted in the aesthetical, not the noetic ethical sphere. Noetic means that which is can be perceived by the intellect, by the mind. There are other ways of perceiving things. Correct. Sherry's point is well taken. The beauty in the mathematical sense. In doing all of this, here the concluding paragraph, the chapter, in doing all of this, Adam the First is trying to carry out the mandate entrusted to him by his maker, who at dawn of the sixth mysterious day of creation, which is what we read from Genesis chapter 1, addressed himself to man and summoned him to fill the earth and subdue it. It is God who decreed that the story of Adam the First be the great saga of freedom, of man slave who gradually transforms himself into man master. While pursuing this goal, driven by an urge which he cannot but obey, Adam the First transcends the limits of reasonable and probable and ventures into the open spaces of the boundless universe. Even this longing for vastness, no matter how adventurous and fantastic, is legitimate. Man, reaching for the distant stars, is acting in harmony with his nature, which was created, willed, and directed by his maker. It is a manifestation of obedience to rather than obedience to rather than rebellion against God. Right? The space program, again, the space program is obeying God. It's not rebelling against God. And he's clearly reacting here to something that someone, I don't know who, must have said from a religious perspective in a negative tone about space exploration. Again, it was just a contemporary, the best contemporary example he could have chosen writing in 1965. Thus, in sum, we have obtained the following triple equation. Humanity equals dignity equals responsibility equals majesty. Really, these are not equations as much as points along a continuum of destinations. Humanity is about the search for dignity, pursuing dignity through being responsible, by having responsibilities, by having imperatives placed upon us and fulfilling them, and in so doing we achieve majesty over ourselves and the world in which we live. This idea of creativity as a central focus in Rabbi Soloveitchik's thought was treated very nicely by one of the great expositors of Rabbi Soloveitchik's thought, the late and lamented Rabbi Walter Wurzberger, in an essay about the centrality of creativity in Rabbi Soloveitchik's thought, which I will post to you, and I strongly recommend. I'll often mention, and if possible, make available to you all of these other essays. Of course, you know, that's up to you if you want to do that kind of outside reading, but hopefully it will form a bibliography of some other Rabbi Soloveitchik writings, as well as secondary literature analyses of Rabbi Soloveitchik's thought, which, if you're interested in undertaking that reading, you know, is really quite beneficial. Again, I apologize. We won't meet for 2 weeks. But when we return, we'll move on to chapter 2, and I strongly recommend that you keep up with the reading, and to try to read ahead, chapter 2 for when we meet again. In the meantime, have a Chag Sameach, Chag Matan Torah Sameach, a happy Shavuos next week, and I'm happy to get your insights and your thoughts, your questions, both now through the chat or through email.